and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with the grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Monday morning at 11am here on BCFM 93.2. This week, John McAllister joins us to talk about his campaign to out Edward Ware, the merchant venturer. Also, we hear about the strike at Windsor Castle. Jacob Yannakopoulos is back. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, and I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But we start this week with John McAllister, who's been doing websites and research about a particular chap called Edward Ware, who owns a company called Edward Ware Homes. Hi, John, and welcome to Dialect.
Hello, Tony.
Tell us how you first came across this Edward Ware chap.
Well, I've never met the guy. I don't know anything about him. But I used to publish a little newsletter, web newsletter, around Redland and Cotton years ago. And I came across a very dangerous demolition site on Redland Hill, which was the former Redland College of Education. I wanted to go into the buildings to take panoramic photographs from the roof, but I quickly realised that the buildings were extremely dangerous and completely unmanaged.
Well, how do you mean? So they were not being fenced off from the public. I know everybody that owns property also has a duty of care, don't they, to make sure that there aren't, for example, pits that kids could fall into, this sort of thing.
There's extensive law governing the control of construction sites and demolition sites. The principal duty is to ensure that no unauthorised persons can access the site, and then the site itself must be kept safe.
So how did you find that Edward Ware had something to do with this site then?
Edward Ware had his signboard outside.
Okay, so you published some information about him. What happened then?
Well, I published a series of short illustrated reports. I took lots of digital pictures and I put them onto my website. And I got in touch with the council and they got in touch with Edward Ware. And after a delay, he made the site safe. He secured the perimeters.
Now, how long was it unsafe for then?
About 9 months.
Crikey. Well, it's lucky that nobody was hurt, isn't it?
Very lucky indeed.
Okay, and you've had, since then, a court case, I know, but we'll talk about that in a minute. But first of all, let's get a picture of who Edward Ware is. I mentioned right at the start that he's a merchant venturer. It's worth explaining for those that aren't familiar with the merchant venturers that they are the sort of elite of Bristol. They go right the way back to the Royal Charter and to even to the merchants that put up the money to finance John Cabot's trip over to America, helping to discover America, and of course really starting a process which ended in a genocide of 75 million Native Americans. So that was the original merchants before the merchant venturers were formally, and then the merchant venturers were involved in the hideous slave trade, where about 6 million Africans who were rounded up at gunpoint died on the Middle Passage on the way from Africa over to the Caribbean and to the Americas. So, I mean, this is an organisation with blood on its hands that really, I think, has to be pretty squeaky clean. But, I mean, from what you're implying as a merchant venturer, that this chap has made a few errors in the way that he's conducted his business affairs. But the merchant venturers haven't sacked him, haven't got rid of him, have they?
Well, I don't know if they know or if they're interested. I simply don't know.
They don't seem to have the proper procedures to make sure that people who are part of their organisation are really up to scratch, whatever that means. But anyway, he's a property speculator, you say. I mean, yeah. He puts himself up on the internet, Edward Ware Homes, property developer. Why do you say he's a speculator?
Well, he speculates by buying and selling, by making planning gains. That's what he was doing with Redland College, except that he didn't own the site, he just said he did.
So let's just explain what that means, because you buy a site with one planning permission, you then obtain planning permission, which is makes the site more valuable, and then sell it on without actually developing it.
Precisely.
Okay, so we've got Edward Ware Homes, the property speculator, the property developer. What about Bristol Diggs Limited?
Well, that I don't know that much about the history of Bristol Diggs, but that is his present company, and he's working very hard and thriving by buying up buildings around Bristol, such as 31 Corn Street or St Stephen's House on the centre. He owns a lot of properties in the Triangle, and basically does it up to a minimum standard and lets it out to students and young professional people.
So he's also got connections with Bristol Rovers Football Club, hasn't he?
He's a director of Bristol Rovers Football Club, and he's been a director for quite a long time. He's also a director of the Memorial Ground Redevelopment Company.
Well, that doesn't look like it's actually happening, because Sainsbury's seem to have backed off from that deal.
Well, it would have been a very lucrative deal if it had worked. That's another deal with UWE, funnily enough.
University of the West of England.
Yeah.
And also in Gloucestershire Cricket.
And he's a director of Gloucestershire County Cricket Club.
So this chap's got his finger in a lot of pies. Why is it that you decided that you wanted to put a website which was up online that was quite critical of him?
Well, I closed my little newsletter, my little Village Pump newsletter, at the end of 2002. As far as I was concerned, the story was dead. It was a geriatric feature. But in the beginning of May 2004, Edward Ware had his lawyers write to my hosting company accusing me of very serious libel. Now, they were very good. They showed it to their legal department and they concluded that what I was publishing was true. He threatened me, but I thought it was reasonable. At that time, I decided that I would put up the website edward-ware.co.uk. But the purpose of the website, the articles about the demolition site were background material at that time, but I wanted to tell the story about his spurious and deceitful legal threats against me and my hosting company.
And that has been in the courts again. I mean, this we're still talking about going back to 2004, 10 years on or so, still in the courts, and it was in court again, wasn't it? Last week.
It wasn't in court in 2004. But at the end,
it was just legal threats. That's right.
He just made legal threats. But at the end of 2011, he threatened me again, and he again threatened my hosting company. Well, this time they just told me to take it down. They said I was in breach of the users' agreement. So I moved the site to America, and I added some more trenchant criticism.
Okay, what would you call trenchant criticism?
Well, I called him vain, full of hubris. I called him Teddy Death Trap.
But I mean, actually, there is an element of truth to that, because he wasn't really fulfilling a proper duty of care with the site that he had. So, yeah, so this has been in the court here in Bristol, hasn't it, in the last couple of weeks as well?
Well, what happened was, at the beginning of 2012, he made a complaint to the police that I was harassing him. And I was taken to Bristol Magistrates Court on a charge of harassment, Protection from Harassment Act. And it was a farrago. I was never defended. The case was never properly put. There was no fair hearing. And I was found guilty of harassing Edward Ware. And at the end of the hearing, they slapped a restraining order on me, which was not to publish or display any material relating to Edward Ware in any way, including on the internet. It was obvious then that the whole purpose of the prosecution was to close down my website. Now, I knew at the time, and I know, the order was unlawful. And I defied the restraining order. I put the website back up again, along with some legal arguments on the matter of freedom of expression and the public interest. And subsequently, he made a complaint to the police in August 2013. I was arrested on the 4th of September 2013, and my computer was seized, my laptop. I was questioned, I was subsequently charged, I was questioned, and then I waited 13 months before I was charged. I was charged on the 25th of September 2014.
Did you get any idea how the Crown Prosecution Service had looked at the police's arguments and said that it was correct to charge you?
Well, the CPS would have made the decision, and I can assure you that they were completely wrong to charge me. And
okay,
I've been vindicated.
So yes, you have, haven't you? Tell us about that case just last week.
Well, I'll just tell you one other thing. I was in Crown Court, I think it was the 23rd of October 2014, and on the 5th of November 2014, I was again arrested at my home. I was taken to Patchway Prisoner Holding Centre. I was kept in the cells for 27 hours, 18 hours at one stretch, and I was subsequently charged again with breach of the restraining order. So the two charges were subsequently consolidated. When I went to Crown Court for the preliminary hearing, plea and case management, My barrister said that we should appeal against the sentence, against the restraining order.
But you managed to get a barrister. What was that, on legal aid?
Yes. Well, actually, no. Because with restraining orders, you can't go back to the magistrates and ask to have the restraining order discharged on legal grounds. They can't rehear legal arguments they should have heard in the first place. And on appeal, there is no legal aid for appeal against sentence. So my barrister, Mr. Oliver Wilmot, was very kind and took on the case pro bono. And he put in a formidable opinion to support a very late application for leave to appeal against sentence. And that was granted. I had a hearing set for March the 16th, but the Crown Prosecution Service asked for a stay on the previous Friday. And finally, we got into court on Friday morning last week. It was a very short hearing. Mr. Recorder Dibney paid close attention. But what I noticed was my barrister wasn't making an effort to show them the website and a lot of photographs that I've got of the site. So when we got towards the end of the trial, they were discussing my website. So I interjected. I said, but I'm still publishing the website. It's still on the web. I said, I've never taken it down. And the judge says, well, we better have a look at it then. And so they printed off a load of copies and called a recess. My barrister was furious with me for interfering. But when the recorder came back into court, he went straight into his judgment, and it was a very sympathetic judgment, and my appeal was upheld.
So you've been vindicated. It's a bit of a David and Goliath struggle you've had over the last few years. You must feel quite chuffed.
Well, the fact of the matter is, I'm a bigger man than Edward Ware.
Okay, and if anyone would like to have a look, Google have delisted your website, though. Are you going to be battling to get it relisted by Google?
I certainly hope so, but I have actually got a new domain that should be accessible. But you don't have to look on Google to find my website. If you enter edward-ware.net into the address bar of your browser, you can find out for yourselves what's been going on.
Also, yes, there's also edward-ware.co.uk. So you've
That's
got a couple of websites up there.
They're the same.
Let's hope that rather than trying to get information which he doesn't like about himself taken down, that Edward Ware actually does something to address some of the health and safety problems on some of his building sites, because that actually is a much better way to do things, I think. I don't know what your opinion is, John.
Well, personally, I think he's enjoyed a very salutary lesson. Don't try to suppress the little man who tells the truth about genuine matters of public concern, public safety, and particularly the safety of children, because he was entirely callous and totally disregarded his legal duties.
And just because you're a merchant venturer doesn't mean to say that you can do whatever you want.
I'd say he's got a long way to fall.
John McAllister, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
I am Angela Balassi, and I will be talking to experts about the changes to pensions. On April 6th, there will be changes to regulations which will allow over 55s to cash in their pensions. Pension Minister Steve Webb, MP for Thornbury and Yate, said the money could be used to buy a Lamborghini. But as cars lose value, we will talk to a financial advisor and a letting agent to look at the options. I'm joined by Derek Royal, partner of Crystal Wealth Management, an independent financial advisor firm based in Portland Square in Bristol, which is regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority, and also Peter Ellis of Accommodation Unlimited in Redland. So firstly, Derek, thank you for joining us.
No problem.
Thank you. Could you tell us why you think the government are introducing this now?
Well, a cynic may say it's just because there's an election around the corner, and this legislation has been pushed through at quite a quick speed. The speed of change has been dramatic, and many pension providers are hard-pressed to have updated their systems in time. The government themselves, they would say they're providing greater flexibility so that people that are hard-working savers get the benefits of careful planning to access their retirement funds when they want to, in a way that suits them. The long-term demographics of this country means that the government are really trying to get people to save for the future, to look after themselves, because the burden on the state will become more and more dramatic as more people, particularly the baby boomers, approach retirement. And you can also see this with further pensions legislation called auto-enrolment that many of your listeners may have experienced at work already.
OK, and what benefits do you think it will bring?
Well, the most publicised benefit is that there will no longer be the compulsion to buy something called an annuity with your pension fund. And all an annuity is that you exchange your pension fund for a guaranteed income for life. But with interest rates at historic lows, then the returns from annuities have been very, very low. And people don't really like the idea that their money dies with them. For me, the major benefit with the new pensions legislation is the flexibility to withdraw capital and income without restriction from the age of 55 onwards. And for people with large pension funds, another significant benefit is the facility to pass on your pension pot to your children or indeed future generations beyond that without any tax payable if you die before the age of 75, or in a tax advantage environment with some tax payable if they die after 75.
OK, well, Steve Webb thinks people may blow it on a sports car. Are there any other risk associated with it?
Well, I think the idea of the Lamborghini, we saw some numbers on that at a recent technical seminar. You need about £350,000 to buy a Lamborghini because you're going to be ended up paying about 45% tax on a lot of that pension fund if you draw it all out in one go. And that's a significant risk for people, is that they don't take advice. For example, if you had a pension fund worth £150,000, the first 25% may be tax-free, about £37,000. The balance of £112,000 will be subject to income tax, and you could end up paying 45% on a lot of that that money. The other concerns are, it's been in the press quite a lot this week, with unscrupulous firms accessing data of pension providers to sell risky schemes, perhaps unregulated investments, or even outright fraud. Now, the government have introduced a service called PensionWise, www.pensionwise.gov.uk, which will be signposted to all people wishing to withdraw their pension funds, and that will be the initial place for people to seek guidance. But I would highly recommend that they seek advice from an independent financial advisor, such as Crystal Wealth Management.
Okay. So, is it advisable to take the pension pot, do you think?
Well, that really depends on the individual circumstances. I would, of course, say that you need to take specific advice and tailored advice to your own particular needs. But there may be instances where people with relatively low pension fund values of £20,000 or £30,000 would actually get far more benefit from accessing a lump sum than a very low annuity income that they may have experienced in the past. For people with larger pension funds, I'd say it's probably unlikely that it will be advisable to take out their whole pension fund in one or two withdrawals because of the tax that they will become immediately due. I would strongly recommend independent fee-based financial planning advice from a qualified and experienced advisor.
Okay, to summarise, what do you think people's options are?
It's a complex subject and probably not for the limited time that we have, but briefly, one can still purchase an annuity. You can take your pension fund as a lump sum, phased lump sum withdrawals over a number of years, or take income from the pension fund on a regular basis. This is commonly known as income drawdown. You could take your tax-free lump sum and leave the remaining pension fund invested exactly where it is now and do what you want with the pension fund.
OK, thank you, Derek. That's Derek Royle of Crystal Wealth.
My pleasure.
We'll now move on to something else you could do with your money, which is buy property. It's been reported that 500,000 people are expected to use their pension pots to invest in property. Peter Ellis, you run letting agency Accommodation Unlimited. Could you tell me if it's advisable to invest your money in this way?
Well, as a letting agent, I'm bound to say yes. But on a serious note, you need to make sure that what you're going to buy is going to be worthwhile. It's very easy to rush into buy-to-let and buy the wrong kind of property, which will be of no use to you in the future. So take, once again, as Derek said, take advice, and before you go into a buy-to-let, talk to a letting agent or an estate agent to get an idea of what your market is. Don't forget, this is always a business. You need to have enough money in your pot in the first place. And if you consider only 25% is tax-free, if you had a pot of, say, 100,000, 25,000 is not a big enough deposit in the current market to get a decent buy-to-let. So you do need a big enough pot.
Okay, and what are the risks involved?
Well, there's always the risk of a bad tenant. Now, good letting agent will reference a tenant thoroughly, a credit check, employment check, and previous landlord check. But people still slip through the net. You see these things in the sort of the paper, My Tenant from Hell, and all these stories. The reason they make the papers is because they're so rare. So that's your main risk, is having a bad tenant. Also, buying a property with, if you don't get it properly surveyed, so you may have maintenance issues or structural problems, which can costs can really rack up.
Okay, but of course, I imagine there are benefits as well.
Yeah, you get a good, if you buy well, you'll have a good regular source of income. You'll hopefully see some capital growth. History shows that property has performed well over the years. Obviously, there have been dips, but over a long period of time. And I'm sure Derek would agree with me that investments are for the long term, not for the short term.
Okay. Also, it's been called the rise of the grandlords, which is the old people buying into the housing market. Can you tell me what effect this will have on the market in general, on first-time buyers, for example?
I think the buy-to-let market as a whole adversely affects the first-time buyer market because they tend to be fishing in the same pool. So a lot of buy-to-let landlords are buying properties that first-time buyers would be interested in. Now, after 2008, the crash of 2008, there were no first-time buyers in the market. So buy-to-let were picking up the slack. Now there are a lot of people wanting to get into the first-time buyer market, and there's a lot of buy-to-let landlords, the grandlords, as you call them, going into the market. There is it's putting up prices. As prices go up, it's pricing younger people out of the market. The government are doing something. A lot of people say not enough with the Help to Buy scheme, and now this the new Help to Buy ISA, which I'm sure Derek will be able to tell you more about if necessary. But yes, it's not a good time necessarily to be a first-time buyer.
Okay, do you think we'll be moving to the European model where we have more people renting rather than buying?
I think we're already there, to be honest. People these days have different attitudes to work, different attitudes to owning. People, there's no longer the job for life. You didn't get married, get a job, buy a house and stay there for the rest of your life. You are flexible. Rental offers that flexibility. You could have a fixed term contract. That contract comes to an end. You move on elsewhere. So rental does give you that flexibility.
Okay. And you have experience of renting yourself.
Currently a tenant. Yes. I'm currently a tenant of Accommodation Unlimited. thank goodness. But yeah, once again, seriously, we've rented because a house we wanted to buy wouldn't be ready in time. We had a buyer for our house. It made sense for us to take that flexible approach, rent something for an 8-9 month period before our new property became available.
Okay, thank you, Peter. Peter will be holding a free seminar for people interested in investing in a buy-to-let on Tuesday, April the 14th. There will be expert talks from financial advisors, solicitors, accountants and mortgage advisors at the event, which will be held at the Unilit Club, Berkeley Square, from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. That's on Tuesday, April the 14th, and you can book on eventbrite.co.uk for more information. Thank you again to the guests, Derek Royal of Crystal Wealth Management and Peter Ellis of Accommodation Unlimited.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined now by Anya Mulcahy-Bowman, who's from Boost Finance. Well, it's a grand-sounding title, but actually it's part of the Barton Hill Settlement here in Bristol. Hi, Anya. Welcome to Dialect.
Hiya, thanks.
Tell us a bit about Boost Finance. What's this all about, then?
Well, Boost Finance has kind of come about based on the back of some research that we did recently, which kind of suggested that quite a lot of people in the Lawrence Hill area of Bristol were wanting to make changes about their financial situation, so they wanted to do something to improve their life situation.
Well, that means they want more money coming in and less going out.
Yeah, absolutely, or being more savvy with their money.
I think we're all a bit like that, aren't
we? Well, absolutely. So Boost Finance, in a lot of ways, is there for everybody. Everybody can benefit from it. Of the people that were wanting to make changes, lots of them didn't really know where to go for support. So, for example, you might think, well, I'd go to the bank, but lots of people don't particularly see banks as helpful or able to offer them impartial advice. So lots of people were maybe asking friends or families, or were just kind of looking at stuff on the internet and would get lost in amongst the financial jargon.
Well, there's all sorts of vultures out there who desperately want to lend you money, aren't there?
Well,
ridiculous rates of interest. So anyway, what can you do? I mean, I'm thinking about really this is about disposable income a bit, isn't it? It's about how much money you've got left over at the end of the week once you've paid the bills. And as we've seen since 2008 and the bailout, whatever it was, 700 billion or something that the banks got from us, that for many of us, that has become a real problem in that our disposable income is going down and down. For some people, where actually your outgoings are more than you've got coming in.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Boost Finance is about financial capability, so it's about learning how to get more for your money. So it's about making sure, for example, that you're getting all the benefits that you're entitled to. It's about making sure that you're getting the best possible rates in terms of your bank accounts. It's about looking at aspirational planning. So this is your situation at the moment. This is maybe your debts at the moment. How can you consolidate them in the best possible way? And how can you look to get a better future for yourself? Often we manage on such tight budgets that the one bill that comes in that we weren't expecting, so the car breaks down or we spend more on our energy than we thought we were spending, can knock us into a spiral of debt that can seem quite daunting and difficult to get out of. And often people feel quite shamefaced about going and asking for help. Sometimes, you know, people feel like there's a stigma attached to just going and asking questions and finding out how you can make finances work better for you.
So give us an example of something, you know, a practical example of someone that's come into you and that you've been able to help. How?
Okay, so for example, there was one individual who came to see us, was in quite a difficult situation. She'd accepted a loan from a doorstep lender to get her through a very difficult Christmas period. She had children, she had expectations on her about how she could manage that period, and she was lent money from a doorstop lender. She was struggling to make those repayments. They were asking her for £25 a week, which was just unachievable for this individual. Through coming into our service and negotiating with Talking Money, who's one of the partners of Boost Finance, she was able to get those that repayment back down to a manageable pound a month. So that, I mean, that's a massive saving. And what I want to be really clear about is this isn't about writing off people's debts or encouraging people to take out loans that they can't afford to pay back. It's about looking at how you manage your finances, how you pay back something that's achievable and realistic for you. So you're not wiping off that. You're breaking it down into a budget that you can realistically afford, so that the stress and anxiety of that knock on the door or that not being able to afford food for your children is managed into a personal finance budget that makes sense and that you can actually work towards.
But we know from Wonga, for example, that they have actually written off quite a lot of debt, so maybe that's better than renegotiating it.
It may be for some people, and if you come in and speak to our experts, that might be something that they would advise for you. What we're doing at Barton Hill Settlement is we're kind of providing the community element that supports people come through the door. As I said before, often people feel quite shamefaced or embarrassed. It takes a while for people to come and present at financial services. They won't necessarily walk through a big shop front. They don't necessarily want people to know their situation, but we do it in a community setting, so it's accessible. We build relationships with people through our community organisers, and then we provide them access to financial services, financial products and financial support that they might otherwise not have accessed.
Okay, so where and when is Boost Finance? When can people come and see
you? Absolutely. Well, we're doing it in partnership with a number of partners that are available on a Friday morning. So at the Barton Hill Settlement, which is at Ducie Road, on a Friday morning from 10 until 1, we offer a free open door service, so you don't need to book an appointment. You can come in, you can have a cup of tea, you can have a free cake, and we'll sit down as community people and talk to you about what your needs are. We'll then work out with you who it's best for you to see, whether it's Talking Money, Credit Union or Brave. And Brave is a social enterprise support initiative that can give you information and advice about setting up self-employed, setting up community enterprises. And we can get you to those three organisations. But what I really love about Boost Finance is that we're a really responsive project. So if a need presents within the organisation, within the project, we look to try and cater for that need.
Okay, so if you've got debts building up, folks, or if you know someone that has, do send them down to Barton Hill Settlement on a Friday morning. Anya Mulcahy-Bowman, thanks ever so much for coming in to see us on Dialect.
Thank you very much.
And your phone number, I'll just give that. It's 0117 954 8881. That's 0117 for Bristol, 954 8881.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And we're joined now by Simon Farris and Bridget White from Bristol Underground Church. Hi, Simon and Bridget. Welcome Hello. To Dialect.
Hi, Tony.
Now, you were on a few years ago, weren't you? I seem to remember doing your own little sort of witch report on Bristol's churches, which was quite entertaining. Just take us back there for a minute, because, I mean, in the Christian world, you've got a lot to choose from, haven't you? I suppose it started off with the Celtic Church, possibly, and the early Christian Church. Then there was the Catholic Church. On top of that came the Protestant Church. Then there's been a more sort of evangelical churches ever since. Give us an idea of the spread of churches that there are in the city.
In Bristol. Well, we found that the best ones, I think Bridget would agree, we like the best were the really lively black ones, like the Redeemed Christian Church of God in Stoke Croft, Potter's House. And quite a few times people, and in response to this good church guide, Tony, a few people have contacted me on email and said, oh, which church do you recommend? Because that's on the website. And I point them to this Redeemed Christian Church of God in Stoke Croft, because it's really, they're really happy, aren't they? And lively,
yes,
and it's good music. That was our favourite. Those were our favourites.
But what about the message coming across from the pastors? Because that makes a big difference, doesn't it? I can remember sitting in a service with an American pastor based in Bristol, and it was actually, I would say, verging on the Islamophobic. It didn't really come across to me as something which was the sort of the love of Christ kind of thing. I mean, I don't know how you want to describe that, but anyway, what are your thoughts about some of the churches? I mean, because you could be happy and clappy, but you could be thinking the wrong thing, can't you?
I think the church we thought was the best, which we've been to quite a few times, is the Trinity Tabernacle with Andy Padgett. I actually thought he's the best pastor.
What is a tabernacle?
Well, the tabernacle is the old place where the Jewish mercy seat and the everything was held, wasn't it? That they travelled around the desert for 40 years with. It just means a building,
a
habitation.
It means a tent.
A tent, yeah.
Okay, so it was a kind of portable church.
It was, yeah.
All right, so whereabouts is that then?
It's in Hassell Drive, just off Lawrence Hill roundabout.
Okay, well, because it is. I mean, I remember chatting to a homeless person once who said to me, "Did you know Bristol's got more churches per square mile than any city
in
the country?"
I heard that when I first moved here 18 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know
in
if that's
the world,
true.
I heard.
I mean, we'd like to think so, maybe, but I'm not sure. A lot of them seem to be derelict, don't they? But what about that one on St Michael's Hill? I was walking past that the other day. And it was used to be part of the city walls, I believe.
Yeah.
And it's just been the Church of England seems to have just left it derelict for years.
But I mean, as we all know, the church in general is breaking out into smaller buildings, their own buildings, meeting in schools, etc., isn't it? So it's moved away from the liturgy and the sitting in the pews to a more interactive, everyone included, type of church.
Well, it's worth saying as well, the church is not a building, the church is the people. So if the Church of England decides it wants to close a building and let it fall to bits, then that doesn't mean to say the church isn't alive and well.
Amen,
actually.
Exactly.
Bridget, I know you've been scribbling away,
yes,
haven't
I
you?
Have.
And you've
yes.
also, after your scribblings, you went to talk to a publisher.
Yes, we met Chris Wright at a meeting a year or two ago, and he seen one of my poems, Love from on High, and he said, have you got any more of those? And I said, about 100 or so. He said, well, I'm a book editor and I'd like to see them because I'd like to help you publish them. So here it is, Hands Across the Ocean, which is a book of poems plus some personal writings from my childhood in Ireland.
So is that your hand or God's hand there?
That's
I can see on the front of the front
my
cover.
Brother-in-law, Colin Lang, he's a social worker. He does quite a lot of this type of art. So I asked him if he would do Two Hands Across the Ocean with the cross
those
and the ocean.
Those are mine and Bridget's hands.
Yeah, like the different groups of people in
right.
different countries.
So the idea being you're on
Ireland.
The west side of the Irish Sea.
Yes, yeah.
And Simon's on the east side of the Irish Sea, and your hands are, actually your arms are so long that you're touching.
Well, we got the cross in the middle, which is the Irish Ocean.
Yeah.
So it's Britain and
the Irish Sea.
Yeah.
Irish, who's been enemies in the past, but now we're all friends. For the
well,
sake
we
of
hope
God.
So.
We've been working together for 14 years since used to come into our homeless drop-in, I remember, the Shepherd's Tent, about 12 years ago, and that's where we started, and we've been working together ever since.
Yeah, I remember doing a crossing of the Irish Sea, actually, on a ferry.
Yes.
And I remember when they announced that they were leaving the port, I think it was Fishguard or somewhere, Pembrokeshire, they said, well, it might be a bit of a rough crossing because the captain, it was a bit touch and go as to whether we were going to set off today.
Yes.
And they announced it on the tannoy, and my God, I'm not allowed to say that. Yes. It was very, very rough.
It's the roughest sea you can go in, apparently.
Is it?
Yes.
Oh, it's treacherous in the world.
Well, I mean, one thing I'd say is if you're crossing the Irish Sea and it starts getting a bit rough, don't stay below decks because you get all disorientated.
Absolutely.
It can make you feel a bit ill.
Yes.
Best thing to do is to get your raincoat on, cling to the rails on the side of the boat.
Pray.
Pray,
thank
probably.
God I don't get seasick.
But then I was stood on the side of this car ferry, and you'd look below, and it was like a crater opening up underneath, and the ship just kind of making these terrible creaking sounds.
It is quite frightening.
It was like all the plates on the side of the ship were sort of snapping or something, but they weren't, because we managed to get across. Anyway, quite an exciting trip if you've never done it. Better than flying. Much you feel like you're really doing it. Anyway, so you're going to read a little bit of one of your poems
now, I've got it. 100 poems or so in this book.
And you've chosen Bounty Hunter to read a little bit out of that.
Yes, this is a Bounty Hunter, which I can read how much of it.
He'll tell you when to stop.
Tell us about the title.
It's the Bounty Hunter. I had sort of a vision of what it would be like to have somebody chasing after you, because I did have once, and it was a terrible feeling of having to keep a step ahead of someone that was going to harm me. So it's based on that type of thing. Who is the bounty hunter that follows me country to country, got off with me at every station, stayed with all my relations? Was it by the price on my head that he was greedily led? If I didn't commit the crime, out of me he wouldn't make a dime, but I have done the deed that will finally meet his need. I have to say it's all my trash that will finally make him some cash, but first I have to be his catch. So I was on the ball when I received his call.
Okay, lovely. And also, what about this? He's actually recorded some music as well as part of your... as part of your Bristol Underground Church, or is this separate, or what?
I'll tell you about that. Have you heard of Graham Kendrick? Famous Shine Jesus Shine and all those... He's the most famous Christian musician of the last 20, 30 years.
And what, more than Cliff Richard?
Well, the one that's done all the worship songs for churches and stuff. And we were looking for a composer for Bridget's poems. Tried for a few years, got nowhere. And so I just typed into Facebook, friends, I typed Graham Kendrick. And this other Graham Kendrick from Bournemouth answered. And he said, I suppose you're looking for the famous one. Sorry, I'm a composer, but you obviously don't want me. And I said, oh, well perhaps you could help. And this man from Bournemouth has produced so far six absolutely brilliant songs from Bridget's...
But we'll make our own mind up about that.
My mind.
All right, so which one are we going to hear now?
Bridget's chosen I've Got My Visa.
I've got my visa, I'm going to enter in. Heaven is my home, and I'm not alone. He paid the price, talking about Jesus Christ. He'll take my sins from me, and he'll set me free. I've got my visa, I'm gonna enter in. He holds the key, oh can't you see? I have repented, and he has relented. He's my judge and jury, and his love will cure me. He holds my sorrow, all my tomorrows. I've got my visa, I'm gonna enter in. I've got my visa, gonna enter in. Heaven is my home, and I'm not alone. Paid the price,
talking about Jesus Christ. He'll take my sins from me and he'll set me free. I've got my visa, I'm gonna enter in. And on the cross, his life he lost. He gave his love, he came down from above. And I've been forgiven, now I am living. I've been healed, the truth is revealed. I've got my visa, I wanna enter in. I've got my visa, I'm gonna enter in. Heaven is my home, and I'm not alone. He paid the price, talking about Jesus Christ. He'll take my sins from me, he'll set me free. I've got my visa, I'm gonna enter in. His love for me set me free. I've been baptized to a new life, I'll arise. His truth rolls on in word and in song. Customs control, I gotta declare my soul. I've got my visa, I'm gonna enter in. Have you got your visa? Have you got your visa? Let me hear you say yeah. Have you got your visa? Oh, you got your visa. Gonna enter in. You're gonna enter in. We're gonna enter in now, brothers and sisters. Gonna enter in.
That was I've Got My Visa by Graham Kendrick. Well, he's not the Graham Kendrick from America. He's from Bournemouth. And you heard also there from Bristol Underground Church, from Simon and Bridget, and more from them next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm pleased to welcome back now Jason Yiannakopoulos. Jason, you haven't been with us for months. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Tony. It's great to be back.
And it's lovely to see you again. But you have come in, you managed to get yourself a job, which is great, isn't it?
Yeah, it's in Windsor, just a few minutes away from the castle, actually.
Ah, well, it's interesting because there's been stuff going on at the castle. It's almost like yes. Trouble at Mill or Trouble at Castle. Have you, as part of your job, I understand you're so near to the castle, you actually have troops marching past your offices.
That's right. We're literally opposite the barracks of the Coldstream Guards.
So what sort of sound do they make in the morning? Have they got drums or drums, well, they're just marching?
Drums, that's all pipes. So you can hear them going past at about 11 o'clock in the morning when you're having a very nice meeting. So
oh, right.
That can be quite frustrating.
So do they march in step?
Of course.
Oh, they okay? Yeah. They probably get shot. Anyway, but there's been some trouble, hasn't there, at the castle? Some of the serfs are deciding that they're not actually quite so happy about getting on their bended knee to Her Majesty.
Well, there is definitely issues there. What's happened is that some of the workers who don't actually work for the Royal Household but work for the Royal Collections Trust, feeling that they're getting a pretty raw deal.
Why is that?
At the moment, they're being paid £40,400 per annum, which is a little bit more than the minimum wage, but it's under the UK living wage.
That's right. Well, I would have thought that being the richest person in the world, possibly, certainly the biggest landowner in the world, with still massive land holdings and collecting rent in Australia, vast tracts of Australia, Canada, of the old Commonwealth, the old Empire, the Queen actually could afford to pay the living wage, couldn't she?
Well, most certainly, there's no doubt about that. I mean, with the strike ballot of 200 workers, 120 of them chose to call possible strike action at the end of April.
And so this is all basically to get them up to a basic standard living wage. I mean, surely the Queen can pay what she wants. We get the idea, don't we, anyway, that the royal family are kind of above the law. Certainly Prince Charles seemed to think he was, with all these letters to ministers. And he wants to have the best of both worlds. It seems the Queen does as well. They want to be have a lot of influence and power, whether it's in of government and ministers and this kind of thing. They've obviously got a lot of influence in the military too. And yet they're in many ways in the law, they see themselves as private citizens, nothing to do with, for example, freedom of information. So where does the truth lie between the two? Are they part of the government or are they private citizens?
Well, that's a tough line, isn't it, there? Okay, what do you say on this?
Well, what do you think? What do you think?
Well, they certainly do seem to have more power than they project, shall we say. More than they give away, because, you know, they give away that, oh, it's just the figurehead, doesn't really have any real power. But I think once you look beneath the layers, it starts to add up. That doesn't add up. I mean, you start to realise they do have some power. They do have quite a bit of influence, after all.
Well, there was a Prime Minister that didn't get on too well with the Queen, apparently. His name was Harold Wilson. He used to have to go to see her every week, and I didn't think she agreed with some of his policies. For example, sticking two fingers up at the City of London. She didn't really like that at the time in the 1970s. And look what happened to him. He had his cabinet burgled by the security services, MI5, various people, came back to find that their homes had been burgled by our own intelligence agencies, and eventually he was forced to resign. So that visit to the Queen once a week, I wonder if you think Prime Ministers are actually biting their nails a bit when they go to see her.
Well, I would imagine they are now, especially with Cameron and Miliband, because the Queen has got a good few decades on them, you know.
Yeah, she's had a lot more experience of all this than they have. Yeah. The other thing is that her personal private secretary has a big say over who forms the next government. There's quite a lot of people saying that after the general election in May, if there's not a proper conclusion, that actually David Cameron may stay on as Prime Minister for a while.
Well, I mean, that could be the case. I mean, the other one that I've heard is the fact that we might be, well, not the fact, that's a really silly thing to say, was we might be ending up with a grand coalition, like one seen in countries like Germany, where the two major parties combined to form a cabinet. Now, can you imagine that? A Miliband-Cameron cabinet. Enjoy.
Oh, my goodness. Well, actually, a lot of people have been voting for fringe parties because that's exactly what they don't want.
Yeah, but some people say, the thing with the fringe parties, it just shows how the British public are fed up of, especially major three governing parties, particularly Labour and the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats. So they've either gone to, God help us, UKIP, or to the Green Party.
Well, we'll see. Also, which way do you think this is going to go? Is there going to be a strike at Windsor Castle?
I hope so, yes.
Okay. Also, you brought along, as usual, Private Eye. Have you got a story out of there for us?
Yes, well, this was called Cash in the Attics. Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond's threat last week caused Vladimir Putin strategic embarrassment by revealing the extent of his cronies' illicit funds in Britain. But it ought to redden a few faces in his own government too, is what it says in Private Eye. Basically, it's talking about limited liability partnership, a vehicle which allows sort of major companies to have shares here without actually a human shareholder. So they can bring lots of money in here, but they create shell companies which receive these funds and there's no actual human director at the top of them.
Oh, so this sounds like a bit of tax avoidance.
Yes, well, you should say that, actually.
And so this is an LLP, Limited Liability Partnership. So these Russian oligarchs that are investing in Britain, are they friends of Putin or not? Because I know he's kind of sort of long battle with the oligarchs, a lot of them.
Well, it appears that most of them are friends of Putin, maybe even his inner circle. Of course, Britain will welcome anyone if they've got enough money. So
that's how principled we are, folks. It's lovely to have you back anyway, Jason, reminding us of our high principles here in Britain. And our royal correspondent, you could now get off of your bended knee. And hopefully we'll see you again soon.
Thank you, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And it's Jeff Sparks with this week's What's On Going. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Tony. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 10th of April, steampunk superstars
The men that will not be blamed for nothing will be performing with support from She Makes War at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:45 p.m. Also on 10th of April, Adam Ant will be playing the entire album Dirk Wears White Socks at the Marble Factory in Avon Street, Bristol. Tickets are £24.50 each and doors open at 7 p.m. Also on 10th of April, High on Maiden will be performing with support from Priest Unleashed at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Into Song of the Week, and I present The Explorers Collective. This group of South London singer-songwriters and musicians formed in 2010 and, in their own words, perform hardcore pop. This is their latest single to be released and is titled Hands Off Our NHS. The Explorers Collective with Hands Off Our NHS. For more information on them, you can check them out on Facebook or go to www.soundcloud.com. Finally, on Saturday 11th of April, Crossfire will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. Entry is free and the gig starts around 9:30 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Monday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guest this week, John McAllister, the webmaster of edward-ware.net, and also to Angela Balassi, Jason Yannakopoulos, and to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. So, that was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
Zero.